I've spoken to you before about the travels that I do on behalf of the church in French-speaking areas, and I work in, of course, multiple languages as part of my work. Work in English, work in French, and then when I travel, I also am translated into other languages and have learned a few words into lots of different languages. That's the way the world works. We are very blessed to speak English, to be in an English-speaking country, because we can go almost any place in the world and find people who will speak English. But that's not the case with people who speak many other languages in the world. Even just from my knowledge of French and English, I have found, and others who are bilingual will find also, that language can shape the way that you view the world in ways that you may not even understand, that kind of channels your thinking in particular directions because of vocabulary you have or because of grammatical functions that are necessary. I would like to do a quick experiment to show you how that works. Those of you who can safely stand up, please do so. Stand for a moment if you would. And I would like to ask you, once you're up, if you can safely do this, if you don't get vertigo, close your eyes and turn around, spin around on your heels one time. Keep your eyes closed as you do this. Okay, now hopefully you'll be facing toward the front more or less. Keep your eyes closed and point to your left. Okay, now keep pointing left. Now you can open your eyes, look around. Look around, everybody did really well with this exercise. We're all pointing to our left, that's great. Okay, now close your eyes. Turn around on your place once again, spin around one more time. Keep your eyes closed. Now point north. Come on, point north, give it your best shot. Okay, hold your hand. Okay, now keep your hands where you're pointing. Please open your eyes and look around and look at everybody. Okay, we didn't do so well on this exercise here. We're having a hard time identifying which way is north. Okay, please be seated. Let me explain to you what we just did. You just participated in an experiment which explains a difference between English, which is our usual language, and another language. Of course, in English, when we give directions, we say right, left, in front, behind. That's the way we explain spatial relationships. But there is another language in the world called Gugu Yamitira, if I pronounce that correctly, which is spoken by an Aboriginal people in North Queensland, Australia. That's the language that gives us the word kangaroo. That language does not have words for left and right, in front and behind. That language uses directions to explain where things are in relation to each other, cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. So they would not say, please move your left leg, or you have an ant on your left leg. They would say, you have an ant on your southwest leg. So as you can imagine, in order to speak that language from a very young age, even young children learn always to be aware of where they are in relationship to north, south, east, and west. A linguist did an experiment one time. A linguist named Lyra Butteritsky, she blindfolded an Aboriginal girl from this country, spun her around a couple of times, and said, please point north, and invariably she pointed north. You could even spin her around with her eyes banded, and she knew what that direction was. Later on, this same linguist tried the same experiment when she was addressing a group of Nobel Prize winners. These are brilliant people in all the sciences and the arts. And when she asked them to close their eyes and turn around and point north, all of these brilliant geniuses did the same thing we all did here. They were pointing in every which direction because their language doesn't require them to know which way is north, south, east, and west. That's just one example. We could take others of how language channels our thinking. It doesn't prevent us from thinking about certain things, but it does make it easier to think about things in particular ways. Let me ask it this time, how many of you speak more than one language? I'd like to see a show of hands. Okay, we have quite a few that are at least bilingual, thank you. How many of you have some notions of another language? You took a year of Spanish in high school. Okay, quite a few of you, that's great. You understand how enriching it can be and how it opens horizons into other worlds. We learn many new things about other cultures and about the way other people think about the world. Charlemagne is supposed to have said, and I couldn't track this down to make sure that this is true, that it was him who said it, but he said, supposedly, to have another language is to have a second soul. That is, it opens other worlds to us, other ways of looking at the world. I won't discuss the theological ramifications of having a second soul, but there is truth to that statement. It does, in fact, open up other horizons for us. All of us speak at least one language. And we all know that sometimes even speaking our own language, our native language, can be a bit challenging, trying to come up with just the right words. And sometimes we blurt something out and we realize, that's not what I meant to say. And we have to catch ourselves. And we say, no, wait, that's not what I meant. No, that didn't come out right. Let me explain what I mean. Because to actually interpret our thoughts into language is a challenge. And if you've ever studied another language, you know that trying to translate from one language into another is also very challenging, because not all languages have exactly the same words for the same ideas or thoughts. There are idiomatic expressions, there are figures of speech. Sometimes there are concepts that just lack, that aren't there between one language and another. When I'm working in French, we have a hard time sometimes translating the concept for mind, because there is no word for mind in French. There is spirit, and spirit, depending on the context, can either mean your mind or can mean spirit in the sense that we use it in English. So we have translation difficulty sometimes working between one language and another. When I was 19, I've spoken to you before about the 6 months I spent as a volunteer English teacher in the Golden Triangle of Northern Thailand, and I learned some survival Thai, as most of us did while we were there. But it was rather approximate, and we all had funny experiences happen to us when we were trying to speak Thai. For example, I can remember one time I ordered a plate of peanuts. We were having a glass of beer, and I ordered a plate of peanuts to have with our beer. And instead of peanuts, they brought me a glass of Ovaltine. Not sure exactly where the translation problem was there, but I actually obviously hadn't pronounced it correctly. Another time, one of the young ladies in the project asked the waiter where the restroom was. He just turned around and walked away. I thought, well, that was rather rude. Then he came back and gave her a glass of water. Translation problems. I went to a supermarket one time in Chiang Kong and asked for a jar of peanut butter. And they understood, and they brought me down this aisle and showed me where the steel wool was. I thought that's what I wanted. So I could go into other interesting difficulties of translation. Let me read you a list of signs that were seen in foreign countries. These were signs in English. But you can tell the person wasn't thinking in English. They were thinking in another language, and they tried to translate it, and we understand kind of what they mean, but we can also see that there are translation difficulties involved. For example, in a Bucharest hotel lobby, this sign was posted. The lift is being fixed for the next day. During that time, we regret that you will be unbearable. Okay, we get the point, but the English is a little approximate. In a hotel elevator in Paris, please leave your values at the front desk. The menu of a Swiss restaurant, our wines leave you nothing to hope for. On a Bangkok dry cleaner shop, drop your trousers here for best results. Outside a Hong Kong tailor shop, ladies may have a fit upstairs. A tailor shop on the island of Rhodes in Greece. Order your summer suit because it's big rush, we will execute customers in strict rotation. Advertisement for a Hong Kong dentist, teeth extracted by the latest Methodists. A Norwegian cocktail lounge. Ladies are requested not to have children in the bar. And finally, a sign from a Budapest zoo. Please do not feed the animals. If you have any suitable food, give it to the guard on duty. So those are funny translation difficulties. And we can see what they meant to say, and we kind of understand what they mean, but it comes out rather humorously. Language difficulties, though, especially in translation, can have more serious consequences. In February of 1944, German soldiers occupied the heights around the ancient monastery of Monte Cassino, about 80 miles south of Rome, as the Allies drove north. It was a historic place, hundreds and hundreds of years old, and so both sides agreed not to defend or attack the monastery so that it could be preserved through the war. But both sides, of course, listened in on the enemy, on their radio traffic, to try to keep tabs on what the enemy was doing. So at one point, the English intercepted a radio conversation during which a German paratroop commander asked, is the Abt, that was the German word, is the Abt in the monastery? And the response came back, yes, with the monks. British intelligence, who had lots of people that spoke German, knew that Abt is the German abbreviation for Abteilung, which means battalion, the battalion headquarters staff. So they had uncovered German perfidy. They had cheated on their agreement. They'd hidden their headquarters staff in among the monks. So the Allies ordered a bombing raid, and they flattened that ancient monastery into a big pile of rubble, which suddenly became a wonderful defensive emplacement. The Germans moved in, and it took months, 4 months, in fact, to take Monte Cassino. 75,000 men died in that battle. And only later was it learned that Abt, in the sense it was used, did not mean Abteilung, it meant abbot. And the German commander asked if the abbot was in among the monks, and the response was yes. The Germans had not betrayed their promise, and that battle need not have occurred, and those tens of thousands of men need not have died. All because of language misunderstandings and translations. Experts estimate today that there are between 2,500 and 3,500 languages spoken in the world. They're not sure of the number because sometimes it's harder to find exactly where a language begins and a dialect or a patois ends. There are some languages that are only oral. There's no written aspect. Is that truly a language or is that something else? And the barrier created between languages creates misunderstandings and it costs a great deal of money. I mentioned to you before, we're blessed to speak English, the most widely spoken language in the world. And in my travels, no matter where I go, no matter how remote it is, I can almost always find somebody who speaks English. That's really not the case for a lot of people in the world. If you grow up speaking Luo or Azerbaijani or Farsi or Kazakh or Ilocano, you wouldn't be able to find anybody outside your country who speaks your language. Travel and tourism would become very, very different. And as I said before, as we're seeing, the language in which we think imposes a certain structure on the world. When my French became more proficient and I started meeting people who were also bilingual, it struck me on a number of occasions that I met people who could function well in English and were native French speakers, but their personalities were slightly different depending on which language they were speaking. Some of you will remember Jacques Cousteau, the undersea voyages of Jacques Cousteau. You remember how he had that really exotic French accent when he would narrate? Well, when my French got better, I realized he's just a Parisian. There's nothing exotic about the way he speaks, but the accent and the formulations of grammar and all of that change the way we view things. Because the divisions of language have caused so many problems over the years, there have been a number of efforts to create and disseminate one world language that everybody could be taught so that the whole world would have a language in common. One of those is called Esperanto. Has anybody here ever dabbled in Esperanto a little bit? Usually there are one or two hands. Okay, I don't see any. Yes, I think I did. A little bit of Esperanto in the back there. It was created in 1887, and it's spoken by anywhere from a few hundred thousand people to 2 or 3 million. Again, we're not really sure. It's a language composed of roots from different European languages, but with a very simplified grammar. It's supposed to be extremely easy to learn. For example, in Esperanto, there are only 12 verb endings for the whole language, compared to 364 in German. 364 word endings in German, verb endings. In English, there are 652. We might even not know them all, but there are 652 different verb endings in English. And nobody told me this before I signed up for my first French class, but there are 2,265 in French, different verb endings, only 12 in Esperanto. The Universal Esperanto Association has consultative status with the United Nations. The UN thinks it's a great idea. It would be a great idea if everybody would learn Esperanto. Then every human being on Earth could communicate with every other human being. They believe that that would advance the cause of world peace. Would it? If we could all speak the same language, would that advance the cause of world peace? Is that the reason that we have war and tension among nations in the world? Is the solution for all of us to be able to speak the same language? Would we have universal understanding? Would there be universal love and mutual respect if we all spoke the same language? Some people think it would. Some people think that's the solution that we need. If we could all just sit down and really talk to each other, we could find a solution. And we hear politicians saying things like that year after year after year. Well, the Bible tells us that there was a time in our history when every human being could understand every other human being in the world. We read about that in Genesis chapter 11. Let's turn there. Genesis chapter 11. Starting in verse 1. Genesis 11, starting in verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. There was a time when every human being in the world could understand every other human being. You could go as far as you could, travel to the ends of the known world, and everybody still spoke the same language. What was the result of that? What did they do with this linguistic unity that they had in the beginning? Well, in chapter 9 of Genesis, in verse 1, we read what God told Noah. In Genesis 9, verse 1, it says, "So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.'" God wanted this human family to spread out, to fill up the earth. He wanted linguistic unity, but he wanted geographic diversity. He wanted them to spread out and go in different places. But some of those families didn't want to obey God. They had different priorities. Their priority was not to submit to the will of God. It was to pursue their own goals. And so in chapter 10, verse 32, Genesis 10, verse 32, "These were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations in their nations. And from these, the nations were divided on the earth after the flood." It appears that there was some sort of plan for the families to divide up the earth and to go in different directions. You take your clan this way, your tribe goes over here, your family goes this way, and there was some sort of plan to do what God wanted them to do. But then we read in verse 2 that there was at least one large group that refused to do what God wanted them to do. "It came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth.'" This group decided not to spread out and fill the earth as God had told them to do. They decided, no, we're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to make ourselves famous. We're going to band together here, and we're going to build something immense that's going to impress other people. They did not want to fulfill God's will. They wanted to make a name for themselves, to take control of their own destiny. Like Adam and Eve, who refused to obey God, they wanted to decide for themselves what would be good. So they used their linguistic unity, the fact that they all spoke the same language, to form a project that was in direct rebellion to the will of God. And we learned something interesting from that, that unity is not always a good thing. Sometimes today people speak of unity as if it's an automatic good. If we can just get everybody together, if we can be unified in our thoughts and our goals, it'll all be good. But the Tower of Babel shows us that unity can be used for evil as well as for good. Unity is not an automatic good. God wanted interior, spiritual unity, but geographic dispersion. And this group of people decided to do just the opposite. The men wanted geographical unity, keep everybody together, because that was their own personal goal. And of course, they were doing that in rebellion to the plan of God. So there was opposition spiritually, but geographic unity, because they were motivated by a rebellious, self-centered, selfish attitude. They hadn't learned anything from the lesson of the flood. The Jewish historian Josephus adds an interesting coda, I guess you could say, to what we have in the Bible. This is not inspired, but this was the understanding of the Jews at his time of what had happened around the Tower of Babel. So this is a quote from Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 1, Chapter 4. He's talking about how this unity of the Tower of Babel came about. So here's a quote from Josephus. "Now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an effort and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe to God, as if it was through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from their fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence on his power. He also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again. For that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers." That's interesting. Now, the Bible doesn't say that, but according to Josephus, the idea behind the Tower of Babel was to build a tower so high that God would never again be able to destroy human beings in their wickedness. It was overt rebellion against God. This unity of the people, this unity brought about in part by linguistic unity, was used by Nimrod for his own purposes. This is perhaps the first identifiable manipulative politician in the Bible, if we discount the serpent in the Garden of Eden. And now we see people do this all the time. You're not being treated fairly. You need to vote for me. I'll get you what you deserve. That's the same thing Nimrod was saying back at the time of the Tower of Babel. And so then, in Genesis chapter 11, verse 5, God steps in. "The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the languages of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth." Babel, of course, later on gave its name to Babylon, which in the Bible and the prophecies of the Bible is representative of all the rebellion of human beings down through the centuries. Human rebellion against God comes from Babel, comes from this rebellion against the will of God and seeking their own self-will. So we see here that unity among human beings is not necessarily good. It's not an absolute good. It's good only when it's used for a good purpose. Human beings can be united in a wrong purpose, and that has happened many times down through human history. Unity is only good if it serves God's will and serves God's plan, if it's guided by God's law, his law of love, honesty, selflessness, respect, respect for God and respect for one another. The law of God in the spirit as well as the letter. When human beings are united to do that, it is a very good thing. But when they have unity of language or a purpose to do something else, it's not unmitigated good. As I travel around the world, I often hear politicians in different countries. You know what I've discovered? Politicians sound the same in any language. They're always making the same promises. They're always trying to make people feel really unhappy with the status quo, that they've been cheated, it's not fair, somebody's taking advantage of them, so you need to vote for me and I'll make it right. They do that in all the languages that I have understood around the world, and even in those where I've seen translations of what they say. And one of the things politicians commonly say is, "I'm going to unite people X. I'm going to unite the American people, or the British people, or the French people." And they sound as if that's automatically good. We're all going to be united. But we have to ask the question, united to do what? Because unity in a wrong purpose is not good. In fact, it becomes an evil. When we study history, we find that human efforts at unity usually have been aimed at applying force to other people to take something from them. The great empires of history came about as a result of lots and lots of human beings working together so they could subjugate other human beings and bring them under their yoke and make them bend to their will. That's how all the great empires operated. The Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greco-Macedonian, the Roman, all of those great empires of history were cruel and crushing to people who would not submit to them. And even down to more recent times, we can talk about how the Nazis banded nations together, and the results were obscene. And communism brought nations together and peoples together and killed hundreds of millions of innocent people. Edmund Burke said, "When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle." Yes, when evil men band together, if there are not other men to resist that, if human beings are left to themselves, then it becomes a very sad, tragic story. And this has happened many times down through human history. And many times, language itself has been used as one of the weapons in the arsenal. We use language in conflict, sometimes for the good. Winston Churchill is in the news again because of a recent film that's come out. I've not seen it yet. I have friends who've seen it and said it was very good. But you can think back on his wartime speeches where he gave hope to millions of people during the darkest years of the Blitz, when it looked like all was lost. But through his speech, he showed indomitable will, and he would never surrender, nor would the British people. You can think of some of those speeches even now. The American journalist Edward R. Murrow said of him, "He mobilized the English language and sent it into battle." And indeed we did. And we remember him fondly because of that. There are examples in the Bible of how words can be weaponized. Words can be weaponized. Let's look at an example, a pretty obvious one, in Judges chapter 12. Judges chapter 12. Judges 12, verse 1. "Then the men of Ephraim gathered together, crossed over toward Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, 'Why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and did not call on us to go up with you? We will burn your house down and with fire. You didn't call us to go out to the fight with you. Now you're taking all the credit. We're going to burn your house down.' And Jephthah said to them, 'My people and I were in a great struggle with the people of Ammon, and when I called on you, you did not deliver me out of their hands.'" No, I called you. You just didn't come. "And when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and I crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. So why have you come up against me this day to fight against me?" Jephthah gathered together the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim, and the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, "You Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites." And the Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, "Let me cross over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if he would say no, they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. We have trouble making certain sounds depending on the language we speak. And we can often pick out people who speak a different language because of their accent. Americans really stand out in French when they're speaking French. You can almost always tell an American because there are certain sounds in French we don't have in English. It's really hard for us to make it, to make a sound that's so foreign to us. Well, it's the same thing here. They couldn't make that sound. And when they would say Sibboleth instead of Shibboleth, then they would take him and kill him in the fords of the Jordan. And there fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. Now, I had an English professor at a master college who insisted that Ephraimites actually could pronounce Sibboleth. They just refused to do so for principle's sake because the English always pronounce things correctly. Now, I'm not sure if that's true. That's what he maintained. He intended that as a joke, I know. But anyway, words were weaponized here. They were used as a weapon in war. And words are still used as weapons in war. We have propaganda, which is a way of shaping information so that people either really want to fight or they feel like giving up. And that's not a new invention either. That's been going on since the Bible has been written. 2 Kings chapter 18 is another example of how words are weaponized. 2 Kings 18, verse 17. This is when the king of Assyria sent an army up to Jerusalem. A conquering army always hoped to make a city surrender without a fight. That was the least expensive way to go about conquest. And so the Rabshakeh, probably a title rather than the man's name, an important servant of the king of Assyria, comes with the tartan. Well, let's start reading verse 17. The king of Assyria sent the tartan, the Rabsaris, the Rabshakeh from Lachish, with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. And they went up and they came to Jerusalem. When they'd come up, they came and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which was on the highway to the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to them. Then the Rabshakeh said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you have trust? You speak of having counsel and strength for war, but they are vain words, and in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Now look, you are trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust him. But if you say to me, 'We will trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before the altar in Jerusalem'?" He's accusing Hezekiah of having angered the God of Israel. "Now, therefore, I urge you, give a pledge to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give to you 2,000 horses, if you're able on your part to put riders on them." You're so diminished, you probably even haven't got enough riders for the horses I would give you. "How then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come out without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, 'Go up against the land and destroy it.'" Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, "Please speak to your servants in the Aramaic language," which was the language of Assyria. Speak in your own language, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall." Why was that? These were words intended to discourage people and make them give up. Make them want to give up. But the Rabshakeh, verse 27, says, "Has my master sent me to your master and to speak these words and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you?" Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew and spoke, saying, "Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria." And he spoke propaganda. He propagandized. He weaponized words to discourage the people, to make them want to surrender and give up. And the Jews that were there, the representatives of the king, they understood what was going on. That's why they wanted to speak in Sumerian. And he wouldn't do it. It was a weapon. Language can be used to communicate, but it can also be used to manipulate, to hide things, to give wrong impressions. It can mislead and divide people. Even people who speak the same language. You can be speaking the same language, a common language, and people can use it to manipulate you. Another thing Winston Churchill said humorously is that the English and the American peoples were two nations divided by a common language. You have to think about that one a little bit. Two nations divided by a common language. But we see this very clearly in the world in which we live today. In our Western societies, language is increasingly being used to manipulate people. They're being weaponized in the struggle of morality that is going on in our nation today. And we need to be very aware of that. We need to be sensitive to that and be able to discern when people are making an effort to manipulate us, because there are efforts bombarding you every day of your life to do just that. And it's going to be increasingly important for us to be able to discern that. In the world in which we live today, language is often used to manipulate. We talk about spin. We talk about spin doctors. We talk about some journalists claim to have a no-spin zone, which is just another form of spin. Claim not to spin, that's spin. But these people are experts. They get paid millions of dollars because people want to hear them couch their language in a particular way. And it brings about a positive emotional feeling. It feels good when I hear somebody say that. May or may not be true, but I feel good when I hear it. They know how to couch the language in a way where it seems wrong not to agree with them. They may make it seem like you're full of hate if you don't go along with what they say. And that's increasingly the language that is used today. There have been some new phrases that have entered English in the last couple of years, and I dare say you're probably pretty tired of hearing some of them by now. One of them you're probably sick of hearing is about fake news. We've all heard about fake news, and this is an accusation made on both sides. You're saying fake news. No, you're saying fake news. This is all just fake news. And it's used to defend. People use it to defend themselves, and they use it to attack their political adversaries. According to the Cambridge Online Dictionary, fake news are false stories that appear to be news, spread in the internet or using other media, usually created to influence political views or as a joke. Fake news is published with the intent to mislead people. It's published with the intent to mislead people, to damage other people's reputation or their credibility, or to gain financially or politically, or sometimes it's a combination of all those things. And many times it's with overtly dishonest headlines. Overtly dishonest headlines. It's called clickbait sometimes, right? You know that term as well. You see something, oh, wow, what is that? Click, and they've got you on the hook. And by the clicking on it, the advertiser's already earned a couple of cents. And when you multiply that effect over millions, people can make a lot of money with things that are just not true. But they pique our curiosity. And it makes it harder to know exactly what the truth is. It confuses people, confuses and muddies the waters. And so if people don't have a very solid underpinning on what the truth about the world really is or what's really happening, they can easily be confused and muddled. Another term that's come out recently is post-truth politics. Post-truth politics, sometimes called post-factual politics or post-reality politics. That's a political culture in which debate is framed largely by appeals to emotion, disconnected from the details of policy or fact. It's just to get to solicit an emotional response. And when people get highly emotional, most of the time they don't reason very carefully. And so we have repeated assertions of talking points without considering the factual rebuttals to that. In 2016, post-truth was chosen by the Oxford Dictionary as its word of the year because it had taken up so much importance in the functioning of Western civilization. After the Brexit referendum, after the presidential election that we had here in this country, post-truth became a hot issue, and it still is. It's continuing to be an important issue in our civilization now. So our communication is becoming more and more confused. And for people who don't have a very firm worldview, it's going to get more and more confusing. God, through His Word, gives us a very firm moral worldview. But it's going to be very important for us and not always easy for us to maintain that because there are a lot of emotive winds blowing out there. As people rely more and more on emotion rather on actual facts to decide what they're going to believe and on what ideas they will act, we as Christians are going to find ourselves under increasing pressure to conform to the majority view or the view of those who are what the French call the masters of thought. The masters of thought are the people in our nation, our intellectual leaders, our cultural leaders, who tell us what we're supposed to be thinking. And that's going on all the time. Hollywood celebrities are telling us all the time what we're supposed to think about this. What's the good way to think about it? What's the bad way to think about it? Words are being weaponized. We're already being increasingly, those who believe in the Bible, we're being portrayed as backwards, ignorant, hateful, evil, intolerant. And that's only going to get worse as time goes on. There are efforts underway to manipulate what we think about great moral issues, the same way Nimrod manipulated the people of his time. And parents and young people need to be aware that the young people of the nation are the prime targets for this campaign. Because educators know, and those who would tell us what to think know, that if you can get them when they're young, if you can get them to think the way you want them to do when they're young, there's a good chance you can keep them for their whole lives. So parents have got to be aware of that and really make an effort to make sure that your children understand these issues clearly. In a vacuum, if you don't help them understand, they're going to just go along with what they're taught in school. This means an active role for parents to counteract some of the moral junk that's out there, that's coming with greater and greater frequency and intensity. The administrations of our public schools are hammering these ideas ceaselessly. Ideas like atheism, multiculturalism, socialist economic policies. And the most pernicious idea of the moment, the theory of a fluid gender identity, which is really confusing young people in this nation and in the West. That's a damnable heresy. That's not the way God made us. But that's what our children are being taught. And so it's really very vitally important that we make sure that we're teaching our children the truths about these things. And young people, you need to be on your guards as well, because in your schools, if you go to public school, some of your teachers are teaching you things that are lies in God's eyes. And that's what determines what the truth is. They are lies. And we've got to be very sensitive to those things. Revelation chapter 22, verse 15 talks about people who love and live a lie. We are in a time when that is very prevalent today. Authorities who should be teaching young people the truth about life are instead teaching a lie or lies that they love and they live and they teach. And the result is going to be unprecedented human suffering. I have a suggestion for you in your personal private Bible study. I would like to suggest to you that you do a word study on three different words. You know how to do a word study, you get a concordance out, you look up the word, look at all the places where it's used in the Bible, read the passages, and then take note of what we learn about that word. What does the Bible teach about that word in this context or in this passage? I think you'll find it very enlightening if you look up, if you do a concordance study on these three words. The first one is deceive, and its various forms, cognates. The word perceive, and its various cognates. And the word discern, which we have chosen to give as a title to our church magazine, Discern. So deceive, perceive, and discern. If you do word studies on those words, you will find that as we draw closer to the time of the end, prophecies tell us that there will be more deception. There will be a risk even that the church or members of the church could be deceived because of the moral ambiguity that's going to be put forward, the moral drift. You will also find that Jesus Christ and his servants, the servants of God, are specifically mentioned as having great perception and discernment. Jesus in particular really discerned what people were thinking. He could look as God, and he looked and he knew what people were thinking. He knew what was behind the false front, what was behind the hypocrisy. Take an example with me in Luke chapter 20. Luke 20. Excuse me. Luke chapter 20, starting in verse 20. So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous, a lot of that going on today too, that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authority of the governor. And they asked him, saying, so we'll start with some flattery, that's always important, a lot of that going on today as well. Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly and that you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the ways of God truly. Now they didn't really believe that. They're just buttering him up. A little flattery goes a long way. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? What does it say about Jesus? But he perceived their craftiness. There was craftiness going on. There was sneaky underhandedness going on here in an effort to trap Jesus so that he could be removed from the scene. But he perceived their craftiness. And he didn't fall into the trap. He said, why are you testing me? Excuse me, you're really out of your depth. Why are you testing me? Show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription does it have? And they said, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. But they could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer, and they kept silent. They'd met their match and then some. But they tried. Flattery, traps in words. Notice Jesus didn't answer their question directly. He reframed it appropriately, and he dealt with the situation that way. He refused to fall into their trap. He had perception, which is a gift of God. God gives us discernment and perception so that we can avoid these kinds of traps. Turn to Matthew 24 also, if you would. Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 4. They ask him in verse 3, his disciples, tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And the first thing Jesus said to them, he answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Why would he start with a statement like that? He wouldn't say that unless there was a very real risk that someone might deceive them. There's going to be a great deal of deception. There's going to be a great deal of confusion surrounding these end time events. And if we're not very firmly founded, we could be caught up in that confusion. That's why Jesus said, be careful that no one deceives you, because that's going to be at work. That's already at work today, and it's going to be even more at work as time goes on. Religious confusion, religious deception, competing theories about what the Bible says. Move on down to, verse 24 now in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 24. False Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. There will be enough distractions around. There will be enough confusing things going on. There will be enough dust thrown up in the air, spiritually speaking, that it's possible even the elect could be deceived. Now, God never tests us beyond what we can bear. We're never tempted to sin beyond what we can bear. He always makes a way of escape. We know that. But that's a pretty stern warning. It should be, I believe, a thought-provoking warning to us. So as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, don't go out. Look, he's in the inner room, don't believe it. Because I've told you these things in advance, you must hold very firmly to what I tell you, because other people will put out competing versions. There will be false spiritual news. It's happening today. It's going to continue to happen. Others of God's servants in the New Testament, as we read about the early New Testament church, Peter, Paul, James, John, a number of them are mentioned of having a gift of discernment that came from God. People came to them with a story, and they knew. God granted them to look behind the hypocritical front and to see what was going on behind there. And so they were able to act in defense of the church. They could cut through all the rhetorical gobbledygook and get to the firm basis of what was going on to see why people are doing what they're doing. The ability to spot deception, to have this kind of discernment, is going to be increasingly important as we get close to the end time. Today already we swim in an ocean of hidden agendas, so we must learn to be alert to them, not be taken in by them. And that starts with communication. That starts with understanding words, discerning what people say. I believe, brethren, this is something about which we need to pray. We need to ask our Father in heaven to give us the discernment, the perception, and the faith we're going to need to avoid the deceptions, to avoid being deceived by the misinformation that is floating around out there. Moral misinformation, spiritual misinformation. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 1 Corinthians 12, we'll see that this is actually one of the gifts that God gives to his servants. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Verse 4. Paul says, "Now there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. There are diversities of activities, but it is the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all." And then he goes and he lists a number of these gifts of the Spirit that are given for the edification of the church. To one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit. To another, the word of knowledge through the Spirit. To another, faith by the same Spirit. To another, gifts of healings by the same Spirit. And it goes on down. In the middle of verse 10, it says, to another, discerning of spirits. That is a gift that God gives. Discerning of spirits. What does that mean, to discern spirits? Well, there are a number of spirits in the world. There is the Spirit of God. There is the spirit of the wicked one. There are human spirits who are confused and influenced by Satan, although perhaps not always possessed by him, not fully to that extent. But we need to be able to discern whether something is of God or not. Whether something someone tells us, is that of God? Can I discern that something like that would come from God? Or is that coming from Satan? Or is that coming from the spirit of men, human spirits that are confused and don't know right from wrong? Human reasoning, thinking, planning, goals. If the church in the early New Testament period needed the gift of discerning of spirits, we need that today too. And the church is going to continue to need that. So I would encourage all of us to be praying, among other things. This isn't the only thing we need, but it is one thing we're going to need as time goes forward. The discerning of spirits. To know whether things that we are being told by other people, whether, does that come from God? Does that click? Does that coincide with what God teaches in the Bible? Or is there something wrong? Is this going off on a wrong tangent somewhere? Is it going to lead me someplace I don't want to go? This is the world in which we live. It's the world in which we're going to continue to live until the return of Jesus Christ. So these spiritual values are of the highest importance to us. When we think about the future, let's cast our gaze forward. That's something we're supposed to do as Christians. Always keep our eyes on the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God finally established on the earth. There we see a wonderful picture of linguistic diversity, but spiritual unity. There's going to be spiritual unity among people of all sorts of languages. Languages are not going to be a spiritual barrier anymore in the world tomorrow. Let's look at a couple of prophecies about that. Isaiah 66. Isaiah 66. Starting in verse 16. Isaiah 66. Verse 16. Let me see, it looks like I may have written that down wrong. I did write that down wrong, so we'll just move on to the next one in Daniel chapter 7. Always have a plan B. Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, wonderful prophecy for the future. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. To him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages, all the 2,500 or 3,500 languages on the earth today, they're all going to serve God in unity. And what a wonderful time that's going to be. You know, when I read prophecies like this, I think sometimes of what it's like to sing hymns at the feast site in France each year. Some of you have been, many of you have actually been there. You know what I'm talking about. We sing the same hymns, but the French speakers sing them in French, and the English speakers sing them in English. And we're singing the same melody. We're singing the same words, but we're singing them in different languages. The words don't coincide, but it's the same melody. And that's a foretaste of the unity that's going to exist in the world tomorrow. People may stand and sing in a different language, different languages, but they'll all be singing to the same God. They'll all be singing with one heart to his honor and glory. It's going to be that way in the kingdom of God established on the earth. This unity of all flesh will be a godly unity. It will be unity turned to a good purpose and to a good goal. It will tend toward obedience to God, obedience to his law and ethics, to the accomplishment of his will, not the will of any human being. And that is the key to perfect unity. Human beings can't be unified among themselves until they are first unified with God, until they are reconciled to him. I quoted Edmund Burke to you before. He was a historian and social commentator about the time of the American Revolution, but viewed it from across the pond over in England. Another thing Edmund Burke said was, whatever disunites man from God also disunites man from man. Whatever disunites man from God also disunites man from man. So when Adam and Eve became disunited from God, it was a foregone conclusion that human beings would not be able to get along among themselves. And that is the history of humanity written in blood. Zechariah chapter 8. Zechariah chapter 8. Verse 23. Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23. Another prophecy of this wonderful future time. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days, 10 men from every language of the nations shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. People of all the languages, when they see an Israelite pass by, they're going to grab and say, can we come along too? We've heard God is with you. We've heard about the blessings he's giving your people. We want that too. Can we come with you? 10 men of every language of all the nations. That's going to be interesting to see in the future because it's going to include some hereditary enemies of Jews and other Israelites. But at that time, there's going to be unity among people because there will be unity between human beings and their creator. Let's think a moment about what's written in Zephaniah chapter 3 also. Zephaniah 3, just two books back from Zechariah. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9 is an interesting verse to think about in the context of what we've been looking at here today. God says to his prophet, then I will restore to the peoples a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord. They may all call on the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord, a pure language. Well, what does that mean exactly? Does it mean that there's going to be one universal language that everybody can speak? We've already read that there will be other languages. People are continue speaking multiple languages, it would appear. But will there be one Esperanto-like language or Hebrew-like language that everybody can speak? A language that is absolutely pure. There won't be any dirty words. There won't be any cuss words, profanity, cursing, no irregular verbs. That's a good one for language students. We like that when there's no irregular verbs. Is that what it means? Perhaps. But I suggest to you it goes far beyond that, because I believe any language could be made impure. You can take any language with any syntax and any amount of vocabulary, and you can construct something impure with that language. Human beings have been doing it for thousands of years. So I don't think it just means that. Maybe there will be a universal language. That's a possibility. Maybe everybody will learn Hebrew. Or maybe there's something else that God has intended for it to be. But it's not just talking about some perfect version of Hebrew or some other language that God would bestow. It's talking about the way the language will be used, the way any language will be used. People will have a pure language. They'll speak in a pure manner because their hearts will be pure. That's what's going to guarantee that there will be a pure language. It's going to be a pure language coming from a pure, submissive, and obedient heart, where there's no desire to say anything impure, where there is a desire not to say anything impure, but only to say good and positive and wholesome and upright things. God's going to give a pure language because he's going to give a pure heart. And then people of all languages will be able to unite in the worship of the true God. Fake news that we worry about today, that we talk about so much, that's really only going to disappear when men's hearts are clean of deceit and hypocrisy. And only God can do that. And he's promised that he will. Jesus said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." There won't be any false versions of it. There won't be any more false gospels or twisted versions of God's will. Come back with me to Acts chapter 2, the context of the first day of Pentecost of the New Testament era, Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, verse 1. "Now when the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. Then there appeared to them divided tongues as of fire, and one sat upon each of them. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when this sound occurred, the multitude came together and were confused, because everyone heard them speaking in his own language." We have surmised sometimes in the past that this gift here may have been as much in the hearing as it was in the speaking, because from this formulation, it seems that perhaps everybody who was there heard them all speaking in his own native language. That's one way it could be understood. "Then they were all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, 'Look, are these not all who speak Galileans?'" Galilee was kind of a backwater. The people that came from there were not noted to be especially educated or a cosmopolitan. You didn't expect a Galilean to speak multiple languages. And here they were, speaking all sorts of amazing languages from far away. "And how is it that we hear each one in our own language in which we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites, those dwelling in Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya and adjoining Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them speaking in our own tongues the wonderful works of God.' So they were all amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, 'What could this mean?' Others mocking said, 'They're full of new wine.' But Peter, standing up with the 11, raised his voices and said to the men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, 'Let this be known to you and heed my words. These are not drunk, as you suppose, since it's only the third hour of the day, but this is what was spoken by the prophet Joel.'" God is working a miracle, and he's doing something new. He's doing something new. He went on to explain what this means. "At the end of the sermon, many people were baptized. The church started with a small group of people who spoke many different languages, but under the influence and the guidance of God's Holy Spirit, they became one." This is, in a way, undoing what God did at the Tower of Babel. The people were united in a wrong spiritual goal, and so he confused their languages and split them up. Now, through the influence of his Holy Spirit, he's bringing people from disparate languages, he's bringing them together, he's destroyed that barrier of language, and he's given them a new unity, a spiritual unity of purpose. It's a mirror reflection. It's the opposite of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Acts chapter 2, still verse 46. Verse 46. So continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. That was a wonderful example at that time of unity, sincere unity in obedience and submission to God's will. That was the goal of the early New Testament church. That is still the goal of the Church of God today. And one day, the reality of the realization of that goal is going to spread to the whole world. That's a time that we very much look forward to. Before I close, let me make some suggestions for things I believe we should either be thinking about or doing in the light of what we've seen in the Bible today during the time of this sermon. After reading the passages and gleaning the understanding that we have from these verses in the Bible, I would like to submit these things for your reflection, because I believe these are things we should be doing. First of all, we need to remember that the Church of God is composed of people from many cultures and languages, and their languages steer their thoughts in slightly different ways than what our language does for us. But we must all, in spite of whatever differences may be there, strive for unity across national borders and cultural barriers. That's going to be increasingly important as time goes on, I believe, because those who tell us how to think in our societies are going to try to divide us up. At least some of them are. They're going to try to divide us up into different groups, inflame passions here and there, in order to manipulate us for them to achieve goals of their own. Not for our good, for their good. That's going on today. It's going to continue to occur, and it's going to get worse in the world in which we live. We sing about that in one of our hymns in the hymnal, O God of every nation. I don't know if you noticed that when you sing that hymn, but in verse 2, one of the things we sing in that hymn is, from pride of race and station and blindness to your way, deliver every nation, eternal God, we pray. Of pride, a race, or station, and blindness to your way. I believe that really should be our prayer. Eternal God, we pray that. Don't let us be so wrapped up in our own personal views of things that it becomes an obstacle to unity in the Church of God. Secondarily, I believe we need to ask God's help and strive to keep our communications pure and honest, because we're affected by what goes on around us. And as communication becomes more dishonest and more confusing and more manipulative, if we're not careful, we can fall into that same way of communicating. Among and between us and the Church of God, our communication needs to be pure and open and honest, seeking God's will, not any personal agendas or personal goals that we wish to accomplish on the back of anybody else. And thirdly, I believe we all need to ask God for the gift of discernment, the discerning of spirits. Is this of God or is it not? I believe we need to ask that for ourselves. I believe we also need to ask that for the Church of God as a whole. I know that those of us who serve in the ministry, those of us who serve as elders, we would appreciate the prayers of the church that God would give us discernment in the dispatch of our responsibilities so that we can fulfill our responsibilities properly. We can have a clear understanding of the situation and what is best and most needful for the church in the work that we do. We all need that gift, and it's something we should be praying about and be very sensitive to as we move forward in time. We live in a time where words are weaponized, where there is misunderstanding and confusion, where people are trying to manipulate other people by the use of language. And we must be on our guard against that and guard our children against that. But we can also take heart, because the Bible promises that in one day, a wonderful day in the future, there will be perfect peace and perfect unity in the world. And people will speak with a pure language, not because they have learned this one perfect language with no irregular verbs, but because their hearts are going to be pure. And when people speak with pure hearts, they speak with a pure language. Then everyone will be able to communicate freely and in righteousness. And then people of every language will serve him.